This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Much has changed in Cincinnati since voters in this city approved a charter amendment prohibiting protections for LGBT citizens. What's different now when compared to the early 90s?
I'm joined today by three activists who are going to help explain to us what gay life in Cincinnati was like in the early 1990s when issue 3 was approved by 62% of voters, and what has happened since. That transformation will be explained by my new friends, Michael Chanik, Scott Knox, and Elaine Atkins. Thanks for being here, all of you.
Yay.
Sure, happy to.
Michael, I want you to take us back to 1993, because Cincinnati was quite a different place at that time.
Oh, absolutely.
So what was it like?
It was exceptionally conservative, and yet there was this whole vibrancy in the gay community. Seems like there's some sort of inverse relationship, Scott's smiling, inverse relationship between activism and the level of conservatism.
They could see embattled community effect.
Yeah. The harder the screws were turned, the more people pushed back.
And this was sort of on the backside of the AIDS crisis. I mean, certainly, you know, the 80s, the gay
certainly
community
at
was
the height
detrimental.
Of it. Yeah.
And then you started to see improvements around the early
90s. Sure, because 93, was it? December, I think, the FDA finally approved the cocktail. So there was kind of a trail, but that was the peak of it, really.
So at that point, did the AIDS epidemic and people's concerns and fears about AIDS
play a role in this? Definitely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Remember, 1991, some people may remember, my law partner Kathy Adams and I represented Stephen O'Banion, who was arrested for jaywalking at 2 a.m. outside of a gay bar, because that's a big problem, is jaywalking at 2 a.m. And there was police harassment of people leaving gay bars.
Wasn't he accused of spitting at the officer?
Well,
and it was sort of dangerous or murderous intent.
Sure. Yeah. Jim Borgman did a cartoon about it, because he was ultimately charged with felonious assault and attempted murder for allegedly spitting on the guards in the Justice Center and the nurse, who testified that his spittle burned like acid.
Yes.
That's the level of paranoia,
hysteria
about about HIV back then.
I didn't know about that case, and I'm not prepared to ask about it, but I'll ask about it anyway.
Sure.
I mean, what happened? What was the outcome of that?
Well, fortunately, we pulled a rational judge, Gilbert Bettman, who was a fantastic judge, and we had testimony from Peter Frame, who founded our infectious disease center here in Cincinnati, UC, who testified back in 91 that HIV, no, was not a fatal illness necessarily. It was a chronic treatable illness. Brilliant doctor, and probably one of a handful at the time that knew that back then and would testify. So it was dropped down to simple assault, and he got 2 weeks suspended sentence.
But to your question, I think if there is a case, O'Banion sets the tone of the question Mr. Monks is asking.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it all fed. It was within a short time after that that you're asking about the tenor at the time that my law partner represented two men who were arrested in a park for holding hands in a car. That was called. They were charged with disorderly conduct, which is creating a condition that's upsetting to others.
Sure made for interesting public radio then.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that, Michael, in just a bit. Let's bring Delaine in. She's kind enough to join us via telephone today. Delaine, what was your perspective on what gay life was like in the 90s in Cincinnati?
Yeah, just listening to Scott and Michael, I mean, definitely it was the era of those people, right? And I don't even think people really even made a distinction about, you know, like HIV, I think, was at the heart of it, but I mean, it was just a broad brush, you know, that we were those people. And I was in the movie. I mean, I think this is even in there about, I was with one of the senior leaders in my organization as a new hire at P&G in 92 when, you know, he made a comment. We had passed a newsstand about gay people wanting to march in a parade. And his comment was, you know, oh my gosh, all those people should just go to an island, right? So there was a lot of those people incidences. And I was new to Cincinnati. I mean, I'd grown up, I'd come here for the summer art series as a kid, but I was a new hire at P&G, and Yeah, it was a very conservative place, and I was out. And so it made in twofold. I mean, on one hand, there was this community to go out into, right? Like there, and it was, there was a lot of fun in that, but it was so oppressive during the daylight hours, kind of, that it was definitely a culture shock for me. And I mean, it's not like I went to school in California and came back. You know, I went to school in Indiana. You didn't think it would be that big of a jump, but it was pretty brutal, especially too, because I was out. And so if I might see somebody out, in the evening and then see them at work, you know, there was a huge risk of me outing them accidentally just by talking to them. So it was very conservative and people were very scared.
Delaine referenced a movie that came out on Monday, and we're going to talk about them because all of you are stars of two motion pictures that have been produced by Procter & Gamble, sort of documenting their own evolution in dealing with gay employees. We're going to touch on that coming up. But let's talk about what was known as Issue 3 or Article 12, as we started to learn it to be called as. So you're openly gay people in this city in that period, and suddenly a ballot measure appears that says you don't deserve protections. And not only was that put to the voters,
They prevailed. Yeah.
Overwhelmingly.
2-1, 62%.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that evening. Remember, did you go to the rally on?
Sure.
Yeah. Remember, and Roxanne Qualls.
We are wonderful.
Yeah. We both have that memory. Yeah. It's a wonderful memory.
What did she say?
It was just an inspiring speech and said, we are wonderful and don't let this get you down.
Yeah, in the darkest moment, you know, members of our community rallied together and went down to the square, and there is the new mayor. What a moment of irony, if you will.
Yeah. It was so personal because it was a vote, but and someone in the film, might have been Delaine, that mentioned it. You walk around in just your daily life and you think, you know, 75% of the people I'm looking at voted
against
that,
me.
That we deserved to be fired for it. What it really was, I worked the polls that day. The religious right that put it on the ballot got to control the language, and the language was really misleading. So the language said, "City Council can't pass any law that would protect GLBT people from this laundry list of things," and so it was. They couldn't require quotas for gay people, no special rights. They used that term for gay people. And then when you get down to the bottom of this list, it said, or any other legal protection. And as a lawyer, that's all I cared about. We were going for quotas. You have to have at least 10% gay at P&G. Everybody raise your hand. I mean, it was so absurd how it would even be practical. Special rights, I never knew what it meant.
Yeah. But if they were special, please.
But it resonated with people.
Yeah. Special
that
rights.
Special rights resonated with people.
Absolutely.
I think Delaine, didn't you?
It became a really rallying cry.
Didn't Delaine, you had a wonderful line in that flick where you said, special rights, owning a home?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, good, decent people.
Having a job.
Yeah. Decent, rational, kind people were, I think, voting, saying, I like gay people and I think they should have equal rights, but they shouldn't have special rights. That was the name of our opposition group. The opposition group was Equal Rights, Not Special Rights. But that was just a tagline to get people to think what we were going for was equal rights, when it was really, if you're doing a good job at work, you shouldn't be fired just because you're gay.
So it would take a little over a decade for that to go away, right? 2004, it was overturned. And was it put back in front of the same voters?
Yes.
So what do you think changed? And we'll start with Delaine on this one. Delaine, what do you think changed in this city over the course of 10 plus years that saw such an overwhelming rejection of its gay population to suddenly supporting it?
I think there's a couple big things. One is just nationally, there was a lot more pushback from gay people saying, hey, look, we're being painted in this certain light, and it's just not true. I mean, this is positioning, and we're everyday people that are living and working next to you. And a lot of us being quiet about it because we've been asked to be quiet, and being quiet is not working, right? Because we're being painted in this light. And so, you know, within P&G, we started to tell the stories of what it was like to be a P&Ger in Cincinnati. So they couldn't say, oh, this is a New York City problem or a California problem. This is a Cincinnati problem, and it's a problem right here in the halls where we work. And then I think the other thing that happened is that I think people just they were willing to open their eyes to the fact that there was a lot of manipulation, I guess, going on in that campaign, and it came to light. And I think people were willing to hear some different messages. And I think that was helped a lot by prominent leaders, including corporations like P&G and other corporations, but even community leaders who realized, like, these were people's lives and they needed to be supported.
And let's not forget the boycott.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, I think that's part of it. The gay community had more or less this notion Stonewall at the time, which was a, quote, preeminent gay rights organization, mm-hmm. took a more moderate approach, and that was that perhaps we should be quiet and perhaps wait for issue 2 out of Colorado. I think that was one of the arguments, mm-hmm. what was that, Romer versus Evans, right. to go our way, which, of course, didn't work out. And it was maybe reasonable to assume that if we were good, you know, we'd get our rights. Of course, it never works out that way. And so they did try a boycott, but unfortunately, it took about a year and a half to get the information out, so there wasn't much of a boycott. In the meantime, the boycott had really just cost a lot of millions of dollars.
And the other piece is the campaign was really smartly run. And I was involved in it, but I wasn't the brains behind it. It was built in a very strategic way.
The 2004 campaign.
The 2004 campaign, yeah. It started with building a broad coalition. So we had endorsements from everyone from Dan Radford at the AFL-CIO Labor Committee to the Chamber of Commerce. That's a range of support. We went to religious leaders. We had NGLTF, the National Gay Lesbian Task Force, come in and train us how to go door to door. And then we did it. And we went door to door and said, and it kind of avoided that special rights garbage. Mm-hmm. We went door to door and said, they said, do not try to pretend when you're talking to a voter that this isn't a gay issue and just talk broadly about human rights. You need to tell them it's a gay issue. They had people at the meetings chant gay, gay, gay to get used to saying it to someone that looks like your grandmother that you're knocking on her door.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our discussion about the transformation of gay life in Cincinnati from a couple of decades ago, well, I guess almost three decades ago now, where 62% of voters said no, there should be no legal protections for the gay citizens of the city, to now where there are rainbow crosswalks in the street and same-sex marriage is legal. I'm joined by activists Michael Chanik, Scott Atkins in the studio, and Delaine Atkins, who is on the phone with us. So again, thanks all of you for being here. Michael, you were a longtime employee of Procter & Gamble.
Just shy of 20 years.
And you were the focus of a new video series that mm-hmm. that came out, or
well,
sort of a feature
year,
film.
Right.
That
20
that,
minutes.
Yeah, that's sort of a nice long documentary, I suppose, then. Yeah. And it was lovely. I got to see that. Words matter. Tell us about what role you played in sort of a transformation of the way one of the world's iconic brands changed the way that it deals with its gay employees.
My roots in volunteerism in Cincinnati while I was working at Procter, of course, was alternating currents, WAF-FM, some of the cable shows, some of the newspapers, had a lot of friends in different political communities. Of course, I knew Scott. And in that process, I guess I got to the point with P&G that I felt change was needed. You know, I made a decision to go to a pride parade in 86. And doing that in those days, working at P&G, certainly they knew they had gay people, right?
Mm-hmm,
they knew it. But to put a public face on it, to do that sort of thing, just wasn't done at P&G. And I outed myself. And as a result, I became the focus of many, some good memories and some bad memories at P&G. But that really was the impetus for me. There was no turning back.
But the company was heavily involved in the production of this.
Well, 25 years go by, okay?
Yeah, and so they've done some introspection.
Yeah, they had gone through the process and they started wondering, just how did this happen? And one day in early May of 2017, I hear from this guy by the name of Brent Miller, who was the executive producer for the first piece. And he's asking me these questions. And he said, well, we hunted high and low. We don't have any records. Well, anybody knows Michael knows he keeps every record, as does Scott, I might point out. So I started working with them, and I was a bit reluctant at first, I admit it. You don't know, after all those years, why now? What does this mean? Is it going to be fair? Is it going to be just? Is it a good rendering of history? I have to say that it more than exceeded my expectations. They did an excellent job, and I've yet to hear any criticism as to the accuracy of the account, which is really important.
I called you Scott Atkins at the top of this, didn't I? And it's Scott Knox. And I just it just hit me in the middle of this when I was looking at my...
Delane and Scott had a relationship with another.
I was wondering if I was married to it.
If I do that, please feel free to slap me in the face and tell me that I'm wrong. I apologize for that, Scott Knox. But to Delane Atkins now, because Michael Chanik's film debut was such a success, they've made a sequel.
Right, and it's called Out of the Shadows, and Delane, Scott, and I are all in it, but since I'm but a minor actress in this one, I'll let Delane take it from there.
Yeah, so what happens in this new one, which, by the way, was released on Monday?
Yeah, so what they do is they take the story of our gay journey, and they take it from the words being included in our EEO policy, and then what happens next. And essentially, it probably would have been the most quiet story ever as we went about our lives, and, I mean, with giant smiles on our face, because we were all very, very moved that the company included sexual orientation in our EEO policy. I mean, all of us have accounts of what that day was like and having to read it multiple times to say, oh my gosh, this is real. But then, you know, nothing else really in the company changed, right? I mean, people who supported us continue to support us. People who didn't kind of got some energy to be more active in that opposition. And so what ended up happening is we decided we really needed to form a group that worked with company leadership on what our needs were. One of the premises of P&G and their purpose, values, and principles is, you know, that the interests of the individual and the company are inseparable. And, you know, another way to say that is, you know, we hire the best and support what else they are. And so we really held them to it. And I will say that P&G rose to the occasion as well, but to Michael's point, you know, sometimes it takes a couple decades for that to happen. And so this tells the story of the gay affinity group, and I use gay for GLBT plus community, but for the gay affinity group to form and to come to the company with our three primary needs that we needed in order to be supported to bring our full selves to work. And that's really what we were trying to get to. Like, this is good business because it's about employees being able to fully contribute. And so that is the premise of the second documentary, Out of the Shadows.
Scott, when we see these videos that document this history that's really not that long ago, what do you think is important for younger LGBTQ people to understand about what their parents or maybe their older siblings even went through?
This sounds like an old man thing to say, but just to remember that they're standing on the shoulders of great people that built this. Gary Wright, who was the executive director of Citizens to Restore Fairness, which was the campaign that repealed Article 12, devoted everything to it. And that the change doesn't just happen, that people it's funny, there's our wonderful Holocaust and Humanity Center down at Union Terminal makes a big deal of this, and it should be made a big deal of, that you shouldn't be a bystander, that you should do something. And if anyone hasn't gone there, they should go there because it's really wonderful. And they include a section on the repeal of Article 12 down there because it was such a sea change. And by the way, it really hasn't been mentioned yet, but Procter & Gamble stood up on that. When we did the repeal, they not only gave a significant amount of money to the repeal, which was politically dangerous for them. They risked boycotts and probably got them over it.
Yeah, did.
Yeah. They also assigned a vice president to be on our board. So they were engaged with money and with feet to
make
sure.
And they sent out a letter to employees, you know, unheard of.
That's impressive. And that didn't happen overnight. That's because of the work of Gable and the other two on this interview that educated them.
Never sell crazy people short.
So we've just got
And I think a big part of it is they put a face to it. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
That's part of what we did. And then P&G also grew to support us in that. Yeah. is that I think people just thought we were so different.
Ed Offshack
started meeting us.
Ed Offshack, who appeared in the second film, had always made that point to me. He says, you know, Michael, the most important thing you did, you made it public. You put a face to it within PNG.
I think that seems to be the most important thing in all of the march towards equality is just coming out. I mean, it wasn't
the other anymore. It was true right here.
It's true for all forms of discrimination across the board. Absolutely. I see it repeatedly that once you can, if you can paint it as us, them, then it's divisive. And once people figure out it's not us, them, whether it's race or gender or sexual orientation or gender identity, anything, when you see, oh, that's my cousin, or that's my neighbor. I don't want to see them hurt. I think Will and Grace and Ellen and all those shows did us a great service by educating people that we would never get in their living room, but those did, and they thought, oh, that's what a lesbian's like. Okay.
They're hilarious. Help.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, we just have a minute left, and I want to get your perspective on this very quickly, of course, but when you look around now at the city and all the change that has taken place, Do you ever think that I'm surprised that this has happened, or do you just feel gratitude for it? What are you feeling?
A lot of different feelings. Certainly gratitude to have lived long enough to have had. I mean, after all, for whatever the Queen City was or wasn't, I've had a rich life here and gotten to participate in things that had I stayed in my tiny little hometown, I would have never been able to do. So it's, you know, here's to Cincy.
Michael Chanik, Scott Knox, by the way, Scott Knox and Delaine Atkins, I appreciate your time so much today. Thanks for shedding light on all of this for us.
Thanks, Michael.
Up next, my conversation with author Charles Kaiser and his revised edition of The Gay Metropolis. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. This year marks half a century since the riot at the Stonewall Inn in New York City, a moment of resistance to police harassment that sparked the modern gay rights movement. The incident is one of many historic occasions and people profiled in an updated version of the book, The Gay Metropolis. I spoke with author Charles Kaiser earlier. Charles Kaiser, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you for having me.
This book, The Gay Metropolis, The Landmark History of Gay Life in America, was updated this year as a nod to the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. This book was first published back in 1997. So I'd like to start with what your perspective is on the 20 years since 1997, when the book first came out. What do you see as the biggest difference in gay life in America now compared to just back then?
Well, the obvious biggest difference is marriage equality, which is certainly not something I expected to happen by now when I first published the book in 1997, and I must say neither did most of the activists who I interviewed at the time. I would say what has been most remarkable about the 21st century is how fast things have speeded up, both culturally and politically, for the gay movement, much faster than we thought it would possibly happen.
In your new intro, you write, quote, "If you are a sexual nonconformist of any persuasion who was born after 1980, I know you faced many hostile hazards growing up, as millions still do, but it may be hard for you to imagine just how invisible and despised homosexuals had been for centuries, even millennia, before you came along. Even straight members of my own generation are often shocked when I remind them of a detail from the dark years before the words gay and liberation ever appeared together. How could that have happened is a question I've often heard." So I'm a gay man born in 1980. So for me and the generation after me, what is most important for us to understand about what happened before?
Well, you know, we didn't really exist as an acknowledged group, or we barely existed as an acknowledged group, except when we were arrested for going out to a gay bar or just trying to be have a regular life of any kind. There were practically no out gay people in America in the 1950s, except for James Baldwin and Allen Ginsberg and almost Gore Vidal, although he never actually described himself as a gay person, although he certainly lived a gay life. And there were no organizations supporting us. In the early 1950s, the ACLU supported the federal government's ban on the employment of gay people by the government or any of its contractors. We had no allies. We certainly had no openly gay congressmen or senators or even barely lawyers or doctors or actors or even Broadway producers. When Merrill Miller came out on the cover of the New York Times Magazine in 1971, he got letters from lawyers saying, if I did that, I would lose all my clients. Doctors said they would lose all their patients. And Broadway producers said I would lose all my investors if anybody knew that I was gay. So it just really wasn't an option. And when I was a reporter in the 1970s at the New York Times, there was nobody who was openly gay at the New York Times. And even by 1980, the year before the AIDS epidemic begins, there are a total of 2 openly gay daily newspaper reporters in all of San Francisco and New York City. Randy Schultz, who went on to write The Band Played On, which was one of the most important books about the AIDS epidemic, and a man named Joe Nicholson, who was a reporter first at the New York Post and then at the New York Daily News. And that was it.
So you've just referenced, you know, 2 iconic gay places, New York, San Francisco. You talk about Broadway and even how in those places it was difficult to be an openly gay person. And yet gay people did exist and they had stories and experiences, and you've documented so many of them in this book, The Gay Metropolis. And you kind of divide the book up by decade, and you started in the 1940s. And I'd like you to take us back 75, 80 years ago. What was New York City like for gays and lesbians back in the 1940s?
Well, if you were part of the upper class elite, it was a very fancy life indeed. And as one of the characters in the books describes, there was always a cocktail party at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when an attractive young man could go and probably get picked up by someone a little older than he and be taken out to the ballet or the theater. And if you were not a fancy person, if you were just a working class man or woman, there were cafeterias in the Times Square area where you could meet people like yourselves. But if you went to a gay bar, there was the risk not only of police raids, but of undercover policemen coming into the bathroom of the gay bar and trying to entice you into a sexual act so that you could be arrested for being gay. There wasn't any protection, there wasn't any way of being open about who you were. On the other hand, when World War II comes along, people are brought together from all over America into the army, people who thought there was nobody else like themselves, and they discover gay culture in ports of exit like New York and San Francisco, and in Europe, in Paris, at places like the Bouffe sur le Toit, a famous gay bar in Paris in the 1940s, where soldiers of all countries used to dance in their uniforms. And then when the war is over, a lot of the gay veterans actually resettle together in neighborhoods and big cities across the country, and those neighborhoods become the nuclei of the gay movement 25 years later when the Stonewall Riot happens. So World War II is really a crucial event, not just for gay people, of course, but also for women who go into the workplace as they never had before, and for black people who prove that they are as courageous and competent as anyone else when they go into the army. And it gives all 3 groups a new sense of self-esteem, which they never had before. But it still takes gay people longer than anyone else to come out and fight for their rights. And one of the things that really makes that possible is the example of the Black Civil Rights Movement, which really provides us with the exact blueprint for everything that we do starting in 1970 in terms of organization, political activism, fighting through the courts, fighting for laws in state legislatures and Congress and so on and so forth.
You wrote about World War II, and I thought this was really interesting because I had never considered or known of this, but you wrote that nothing would have a great impact or as great an impact on the future shape of gay life in America than the explosive growth of the U.S. Army during World War II.
And in your section on World War II, I found another piece really interesting. You profile an American named Stephen Reynolds, and he worked in the American Field Service during World War II. And you write about his friendship during that war in Egypt with Bert Shivlov, who wrote the book for the musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And you quote Reynolds as saying of his friend Bert, "He was the loveliest man who ever lived. He had a sensational sense of humor. We used to call Hitler Helen. And we'd be in the desert, and there'd be a lot of German planes, and we'd say, 'Helen's angry today. God, she's mad.'" And I wanted to note that passage because even today, that's a very recognizable gay sensibility, the feminization of a man in a joking tone. And how do you think some of those aspects of the traditional gay sensibility has managed to survive all these decades?
Well, I think there is something intrinsic about certain kinds of gay people who have always reacted the same way over the centuries. You know, there are a lot of gay academics who believe that there was nobody before 1900 who thought of themselves as gay, and I don't believe that for a minute, because I think the one thing we know from Shakespeare or even from the Bible is that human nature has never changed over many centuries. So I think there is something intrinsic for a certain class of gay person which has never changed and never will change and is something for us to be grateful for and proud of.
Well, let's jump ahead some decades and go to June of 1969. That was the catalyst for the new edition of the Gay Metropolis. It's the date of the Stonewall Uprising in New York City. And this event is often described as a riot involving patrons at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar, and New York City police, and is typically referred to as a turning point in the fight for gay rights. Why does this event retain such significance today?
Well, it really does uncork a whole movement in one night or in one series of demonstrations that happened over 3 or 4 days after the initial Stonewall riot. There is an incredible amount of organizational activity, beginning with the first leaflets of the Gay Liberation Front, which are distributed in New York in July of 1969, and the headline on them is, "Do you think homosexuals are revolting?" And the answer was, "You bet your sweet ass we are." And there were, you know, 4 or 5 gay organizations in the country in 1969, including the first gay student group at Columbia University, founded in 1967, the Student Homophile League, which was originally thought of as a April Fool's prank by the Columbia Daily Spectator until they found out it was a real thing, and then they ran an editorial endorsing it. But by the end of 1971, 2 years after the Stonewall riot, there were a couple of thousand of gay organizations at universities across the country, including Catholic universities like Notre Dame. And there was just an unbelievable amount of organizational activity. And in 1972, you have the first attempts to get candidates to take positions on gay issues, Senate candidates in New York, and even to some extent George McGovern in 1972. I think there's an effort to put some kind of gay plank in the Democratic platform in 1972. Things just take off, and things like that Merrill Miller piece on the front, on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. He's the first writer to come out as gay in the New York Times, probably up until that time, which is remarkable. Things just take off in a very fast and national way, and you have the first 3 gay marches on the anniversary of the Stonewall riot in the summer of 1970 in New York, and I think 4 actually, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles all have. And this is the first time in New York City in 1970 that people have seen thousands of self-identified homosexuals walking up Fifth Avenue to Central Park. Nobody had ever seen that many people calling themselves gay in public before. And of course, the fact that we existed was the most important step in our being recognized and accepted. And even back in the early 1950s, when the first important gay nonfiction book is published, The Homosexual in America, Edward Segarin writes in that book, "If only everyone could come out of the closet at the same time, what a difference that would make. Well, of course, we reached that point in a horrifying way in the 1980s when the AIDS epidemic begins, and it does, in fact, force so many people out of the closet at once, including famous people like Rock Hudson.
And that's something that I want to explore here. First, let me let the listeners know that this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. I'm speaking with Charles Kaiser. He's the author of The Gay Metropolis, The Landmark History of Gay Life in America. It's been updated in a new edition to commemorate the 50-year anniversary of Stonewall. And in your chapter on the 70s, Charles, you do note a lot of the significance for the mainstreaming of gay life. You note that in 1972, Hal Holbrook and Martin Sheen starred in the first gay-themed made-for-TV movie. We had that docuseries on PBS, An American Family, which prominently featured a gay member of the Loud family, Lance. The movie version of the musical Cabaret was released, and we recently saw that pretty well detailed in the FX miniseries Fosse Verdon. Harvey Milk elected to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. It was also a decade of sexual freedom. But as you were just starting to note, it was immediately followed by the 1980s and the AIDS crisis that decimated the gay population and put a stigma of fear on it all again. And I wonder, from your perspective, looking back, does it seem that gay rights in this country had been on a faster pace only to be slowed down by AIDS?
No, I think really the opposite was true, because AIDS, I've always described as the worst thing and the best thing that ever happened to us. The worst thing because it wiped out half of my generation, obviously. But the best thing because it compelled us to become organized in a way that we had never been organized before. And people like Larry Kramer, who's an extraordinarily important figure in the history of the gay movement, as one of the founders of the gay men's health crisis, and then later on of ACT UP, he somehow manages to harvest out of all this trauma an organizational spirit and a fighting spirit, which leads to a transformation in the way new drugs are introduced in America, and also leads to all kinds of collaborations between gay activists and scientists, which really quite remarkably, although the immediate initial response of the federal government and everyone else was terrible and extremely neglectful, but on the other hand, within 15 years, because of all this gay activism and their collaborations with scientists, there was a drug by the late 1990s which pretty much made this, for those people who were, at least had access to that drug, a manageable disease that you could live with relatively few side effects. And the fact that it was almost cured within 15 years is an extraordinary achievement. It also leads to all kinds of new organizations, you know, for doctors, for gay lawyers, for gay journalists. The Gay Journalists Association, which I was the president of the New York chapter of in the early 1990s, that wasn't founded until 1991 by Roy Ahrens, a fantastic alumni of the Washington Post and the Oakland Tribune. And he was the first person to found such an organization. And before it, people like me in New York, gay reporters in New York, did not have any idea who the gay reporters were in Philadelphia or Washington or Chicago or anywhere else. And this created a network of gay journalists that had never existed before. And it also created lobbies in every big city in the country to get major media outlets to do two things: treat their gay employees more fairly and cover gay issues more thoroughly than they ever had before. And we had an incredibly important ally in Arthur Sulzberger Jr., who was the man who became the publisher of the New York Times in the 1990s, succeeding his father, who is not a progressive on this subject, but Arthur Jr. was a child of the 60s. And thought all people should be treated equally. And at the very first convention of the Gay Journalists Association in San Francisco, he sent a video in which he promised to fight for domestic partnership benefits for the partners of gay reporters, which in 1991 was a revolutionary thing to do. And he also, by the way, figured out who all the gay reporters were on the city staff of the New York Times, took each of them out to lunch and said, "I know you're gay," which horrified them initially. And then he said, "Don't worry, it won't make any difference. As soon as the current editor, Abe Rosenthal, is gone, I'll make sure that you can come out of the closet and it will have no effect on his career, on your career." And he did that, and he kept that promise. And as a result, the New York Times really more rapidly than any other major American institution went from being completely homophobic to completely gay-friendly within just a period of a year or two in the late 80s. And it also, for the first time, allowed people to use the word gay outside of quotation marks or outside the name of an organization. Until then, you could not say the word gay in the New York Times unless you were quoting somebody else.
Well, let's talk about today. And what I'm noticing, particularly as Pride season, as it's known, starts to kick off, I notice some, I guess you could call it infighting among those who comment on what we now call the LGBTQ community. And a lot of times it centers around Stonewall and the actual event itself. You hear different versions or people being militant about who threw the first rock and what type of intersectionality is involved in that. Was it a white guy or was it a trans Black woman of color who also happened to be a sex worker? And there's a lot of arguing over who's being erased or which group has too much privilege or attention. And I know that you work in a college setting at the LGBTQ Policy Center at Hunter College. And I want to know if you've observed what I just referenced there at all.
Well, certainly there's an ongoing fight about who started it. I think it's very clear that there was every kind of person at the Stonewall, and that was its appeal to its patrons. There were hippies, there were white men in suits, there were trans people, there were people of color, and certainly there is a great unanimity among people who were there that night that the person who threw the first stone or first brick was most likely a lesbian of color or a trans person of color. Stormy DeLavari is my own personal candidate, who is a cross-dressing lesbian who always dressed in men's clothing and who says the cop hit me and I hit him back, which I believe is true. But sure, we're still arguing about who the first person was, but the important thing is that we have to learn to appreciate every kind of person on the sexual continuum, and we need to be more united among ourselves because there's not all that many of us to begin with that we can afford to be fighting among ourselves when we have such large and visible enemies in the White House right this minute.
I wonder if you were to revisit this book 50 years from now and come out with a new edition, what do you think would be the major theme in the chapter on the 2010s?
Well, the 2010s is really the period of the, at least legally and culturally, it's the period of the most rapid progress since the movement began, because the gay marriage thing just sort of takes off and becomes an issue that unites gay men and lesbians in a very substantial way. And three of the most important lawyers are lesbian lawyers who push this agenda forward. And then culturally, beginning with the English Queer as Folk, and then the American Queer as Folk, and then Brokeback Mountain, and then by the end of the 1910s, you have 50 different shows on Netflix with gay characters, as well as Moonlight, the first Black gay movie to win Best Picture. So it's everything accelerates to an incredible extent. And the election of Barack Obama, his appointment of two Supreme Court justices, and his real commitment to this cause, even though people accuse him of being slow on marriage equality, which he was compared to Joe Biden and others, but ultimately this was the man who did more for gay people than any other American politician ever, and we have a lot to be grateful to him for.
The book is called The Gay Metropolis, The Landmark History of Gay Life in America. It's been updated this year, 50 years after Stonewall. The author is Charles Kaiser. Charles, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Mullis.